Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. On today's show, a documentary about a musician who looks to folk artist Lucinda Williams for inspiration. Then a singer honors the historical Compton's cafeteria riots and the Tenderloin. And a documentary about hedge funds destroying local newspapers and how journalists are fighting back. Today's show is about people who paved the way. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. Have you ever felt stuck in your creative process or career and looked to those before you who succeeded? I know I have. Ismay is an alternative folk music artist dealing with some self-doubt as a creative. She's questioning whether to stay in music or remain a farmer in Petaluma. So she takes a road trip throughout the Deep South to learn about the early career of a music icon she admires, Lucinda Williams. Ismay chronicles this journey of self-discovery in the documentary Finding Lucinda. Here's Ismay chatting with musician Charlie Sexton, a longtime collaborator of Lucinda Williams.
What parts of her music do you think you incorporated into, like, your own style?
If I ever got anywhere, like, 1,000 miles close to what she's capable of doing, it were the songs that were like a Pandora's box. And I was like, okay, I'm just going to tell the story. Mm. What it takes for any artist, what it takes to actually achieve that thing that makes you maybe take a big breath or a little breath or like feel it in your core, that costs something to that person.
Finding Lucinda is screening this Friday at the Four Star Theater in San Francisco. It's part of Harley Strictly Bluegrass Out of the Park events. I spoke with Ismay about her film and career aspirations. Ismay, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I can relate to this film. I think a lot of artists can relate to this film. You are exploring not just Lucinda Williams' background and her trajectory in the music industry, but also to exploring yourself as an artist and your self-doubts as an artist. I think that was courageous of you to be vulnerable and put that on film.
Well, thanks. It's, you know, it's always a challenge to try to find that honesty in your story that you hope somebody else can relate to. But I think ultimately, if you don't share that, how can people connect, you know?
And the film, too, you know, emotionally, it paints a picture, but also, too, definitely visually, because we start the film off, or you start the film off, we're in Petaluma, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful rural scenery, which is your home, because you're a farmer, so you are farming and making music.
Exactly. It kind of starts, yeah, the whole story kind of started because of my Bay Area history. I grew up in San Francisco and Marin County, and then my grandfather had started Harley Strictly Bluegrass. So when I was a kid, I watched these amazing roots music artists and had this love of music, but I never thought I could be a musician. And then I kind of had this dream emerge when I was living in Berkeley and going to college and decided I wanted to be a musician. But then I had these kind of two paths. I was working on my family's ranch and playing music and not really sure where I belonged and where I could put value into the world was really what I was worried about.
Being around your grandfather, who is the late F. Warren Hellman, again, founder of Harley Strictly Bluegrass Festival, did being around him and all those artists, did that prepare you for the music industry? Or it didn't show all the struggles that goes behind the music industry? You know, maybe it seemed candy-coated to you in a way because you already saw these people that had reached a certain platform.
Exactly. I mean, you have this entry point into a world. And so you have this whole realm that I probably wouldn't have been exposed to otherwise. But then you have this sort of secondary thing where exactly what you said, you kind of see this candy-coated, you see the most successful people, you just see them at the height of their powers performing at an amazing festival, and you kind of gloss over the complicated stories that everybody has to go through to get where they are. And the fact that, you know, you don't actually know, just because they're up on that stage performing in a seemingly triumphant way, doesn't mean you understand their whole life. And so it was sort of like great to kind of have like a destiny, you know, to feel like, okay, maybe this is what I'm here to do. But at the same time, it just puts a lot of pressure, and it puts a lot of, I don't know, I guess pressure is just the word I would say. So it makes it complicated, and then it sort of makes it feel like I could be something, but am I capable of being that personally?
And in the film, as we know, you're a big admirer of Lucinda Williams. So what was it, or what is it about her story that motivates you as an artist? I mean, I know you say you appreciate her craft, but you're in a space, at least in this film, where you're questioning if you should even pursue music. What is it about her and her journey where it's giving you hope or understanding of how you should be as an artist or who you are as an artist?
I think the thing that I've gained hope, understanding of being an artist is that it kind of goes into two ways. One way is it took her a really long time to find the acceptance that she was seeking. She started performing when she was 15 years old. And then, you know, she didn't really find her triumphant, iconic album, Car Wheels on a Gravel Road. She didn't make that until she was in her late 30s and 40s. And so I think it's very inspiring to see an artist that spent 20, 30 years working, performing, pursuing, and not giving up in spite of all the setbacks that she had. And secondly, is just there's actually a lot of literature and history and poetry and craft, poetic writing behind her story that she had to learn about in order to become such a great songwriter. So I think it inspires me to remember that, you know, being an artist is a lifelong commitment. It's not something that you do or you don't have. It's something that's about being committed to the love of what you create, but also that you can look towards other people's work and incredible forms of art that may not be exactly your art form and become better at what you do, and also just be more in love with your own art form.
And too, what's interesting about Lucinda, I know who she is. I don't know much about her. I learned definitely a whole lot about her in this film. I mean, her father was a poet. She traveled around a lot. I mean, she just has so much life experience. And I'm thinking too about today, the music industry is so different, right, than when she was coming up. What is success for Ismay, for Ismay's career? Like, what do you want for yourself?
Yeah. I think for me, success is always sort of like a moving target, because sometimes it's more oriented around, well, I want to play, you know, these shows and have this many people come. And sometimes that feels good, but sometimes, you know, you get back to your house at the end of the night and you're like, was that really all this was for? And so I've had to try to always kind of reorient myself to success as being the ability to feel like every album I make is better. I know better is not the correct word exactly, but each album that I make feels like I've not avoided the pieces of my work that I wish always could improve. So, you know, I think most artists want some degree of feeling like our work matters and that we're accepted and that people want us to come perform at their festivals. And that's always a great feeling. But I think the more I can define my success about my own work and writing and ensuring that I'm growing and not staying in the safe spaces of my writing, that feels like the important success to me.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Ismay. Her documentary is Finding Lucinda. There'll be a screening at the Four Star Theater in San Francisco on Friday, October 3rd. And this is part of the lineup of events for Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Out of the Park. So in the film, you're on this journey. You go to the Deep South. You're in Texas. You're in Louisiana. You're in Mississippi. You converse with these people who have worked with her, many of them producers. Some of them had saw Lucinda like early on, you know, when she was a novice at this, works that I was impressed by with the songwriting and music, but we later learned she kind of cringed, like, you know, like that needs to stay in the drafts pile, right? And I was like, that's good. It's still good. Sounded good to me. Was there anything that surprised you when learning about her?
I was surprised by her fortitude and her sense of purpose. I was surprised by her boldness, I think, and her confidence. I mean, I think one thing I realized through making the film is that me and her maybe aren't that similar in terms of our personalities, but there's still a lot to be learned from her story and who she was. But I also think the thing that I didn't realize when I set out is that she had this history of her dad being a poet and being friends with some of the most incredible writers. And that really informed her work. And I was talking to somebody and they were saying how, oh, well, you know, Lucinda Williams is just a poet set to music. And in a way, that's kind of accurate. I didn't understand that when I started out, though.
Yeah, definitely her work is poetic. I feel that, but I feel like that about a lot of musicians. Mm-hmm. And good songwriters, because sometimes I listen to songs and I'm like, wow, that's poetry. Yeah. And you have a beautiful voice and you're definitely great at playing the guitar. So, too, when people watch the film, there's so much music coming from you.
I stepped outside my door, worried about the lightning today. Walked down to the barn and I stacked up my arms full of hay, as I do in the evening time.
Where do you draw the line between Lucinda's journey and finding yourself as an artist? As I was telling you earlier, I know when I was struggling about, do I want to stay a writer? Do I want to stay a journalist? Sometimes I would watch Toni Morrison documentary just to get some understanding about the importance of being a writer and to motivate me to not to give up. Because, again, I know how you feel. But, yeah, I wanted to know, I said, where's the line here? Because sometimes it felt like it blurred a little bit. Sometimes it felt separate.
Yeah, I really like that story you're talking about, because I think the film is about, it's about Lucinda, but it's about how anybody relates to somebody they look up to. And I think when you're talking about sort of the line between my journey and hers, it does kind of start to blend. And I think a big piece of what I learned through sort of paralleling those two paths is that just because somebody might have this set of accolades or triumphs that you see as somebody who admires another artist doesn't mean that they always feel triumphant. It doesn't mean that the process for them was easy. It doesn't mean that they didn't think about giving up.
And Lucinda is in the film. We do see her. So has she seen the film?
So yes, she's seen it. And I think she's really enjoyed it and getting to see somebody younger who really admires her journey. And the cool thing about her is I think I wasn't sure what to expect, but she really gets being an artist. She can speak to it really well. And she's a kind of an artist where she appreciates lots of different kinds of music and art forms. And it's inspiring to talk with somebody like her who is such a great artist, but also sort of really understands and believes in the artistic process.
And that's another courageous thing that you did, the fact that you did a documentary on a legend. I mean, that's...
I know. You know, I didn't start out trying to do it that way. It just happened gradually. And man, you know, we look back sometimes like, wow, this really escalated quickly. But I don't know. It was a challenge. I mean, it's been a huge challenge. The hardest thing probably I've done, creatively speaking. And it's been rewarding, but, you know, one foot in front of the other is, I guess, how I had to do it.
So you have this film. We see you go on this, you know, musical adventure. And I know you were questioning, do I just stay on the farm? Do I do music? Do I do both? So where are you at now?
Yeah, I think there's kind of two things that I took away from the film. And one is that I did decide that, you know, it's worth being a musician and putting myself out there and not necessarily also working on the ranch. And so I did decide to embrace pursuing music more seriously and not trying to split my time. But I also think I realized through the process that I don't know the reception. I don't know the amount of people that are going to care. I don't know how it's going to interact in the real world. I don't know if I'll ever have a trajectory like Lucinda in any way. But I have to remember that being an artist is about more than that. And always, you know, it's never going to go away. I don't think any of us are immune to the thoughts about what our work means when it's in the world. But trying to stay centered in the creative process and the belief that no matter whether you're the only person that hears it or if millions of people care, that your work and your creativity matters and it's worthwhile just to be creative as a human being.
Ismay, I wish you luck and I thank you for chatting with me today.
Thank you so much. This has been a blast.
That was folk artist Ismay. Watch Finding Lucinda at the Four Star Theater in San Francisco this Friday. And in case the show is sold out, you can also watch it on Apple TV, Amazon, and other streaming platforms. And Lucinda Williams herself will be performing at the Harley Strictly Bluegrass Music Festival this Sunday. Coming up, singer Melanie Damore and I chat about music, Ariel, and trans history in the Tenderloin. Stay with us.
Now you're free. I'm sending you light to heal you, to hold.
You're listening to the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. In 1966, a riot broke out in San Francisco's Tenderloin District. People were fed up with police violence against trans women and drag queens, and this historic event became known as Compton's Cafeteria Riot. This is one of the first acts of organized LGBTQ plus resistance in the United States. Compton's Cafeteria Riot was a few years before the Stonewall Uprising, which was the catalyst for Pride. A new public art project called Down on the Corner is honoring the uprising, and you can see from October 3rd to the 11th on the corner of Turk and Taylor Street in San Francisco, which is near where Compton's Cafeteria Riot took place. And the project features a cast of queer, trans, and female dancers and musicians. And one of those performers is singer-songwriter Melanie Damore, who composed original music for Down on the Corner. Melanie is a three-time Grammy-nominated artist, and her music just touches your soul. Melanie, I'm so happy you're here. I was playing your music before you came on, zoning out.
Oh, thank you, sweetie. I sure appreciate that.
Yes, it's almost ancestral when your music is, it takes you to another time and another place.
Thank you.
Before we even dive in more to the interview, I just want to expand more about the history of Compton's Cafeteria Riots. Mm-hmm. So I was reading in a 2019 article of The Guardian that Gene Compton's Cafeteria was an all-night restaurant in the Tenderloin. It was a popular spot for folks in the queer community. And a police officer put his hand on a trans woman, and a trans woman, I don't know if it was the same trans woman, threw a cup of coffee in the officer's face. It was the same one. Okay. And so in the article, it says women, they were throwing sugar shakers through the glass windows.
It's a cafeteria, whatever was at hand.
The cafeteria fight, right?
You know, it's like the ultimate food fight.
Right,
okay?
Exactly. Okay, drag queens were beating police officers with their purses. Police cars got destroyed. A new set set on fire. They weren't playing. Women were arrested. And I did not learn about this till maybe a decade ago. You know, we hear about Stonewall. And, you know, for a lot of people, Stonewall is new. And I'm like, this happened here in the Bay Area?
This was 3 years before Stonewall.
Right. This was before Stonewall.
3 years before Stonewall.
So how did you feel learning about that?
Well, it was really interesting to me. First of all, Joe Kreider, who is the founder and director of Flyaway Productions, which is the organization that's doing this piece. I had no idea about it until she contacted me about wanting to do the music. Mm-hmm. And so then I started finding out and listening to some of the interviews that she was doing with Susan Stryker, who is bad to the bone. Mm-hmm. That woman is bad to the bone and a great historian and very knowledgeable about the whole Compton thing. That's really one of her focuses in her work.
So she interviewed people who were there at that time?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. So what's the setup for Down on the Corner? I've seen images and I've seen people climbing on walls and you have this beautiful music. So tell us, like, what can people expect or what should they look out for? Because it's on the street.
It's on the street, and it all happens literally on this one building. So the audience will actually move. And so you will see aerialists and the dancers swinging from windows and all kinds of stuff. And what I love is the fact that it's taking place. There's a beautiful film done by Lila Weaver.
Yes. Uh-huh.
That will be projected on the building, and you can hear the sound all the way through the Tenderloin. And that's another thing. I love mm-hmm. the fact that this took place in the Tenderloin, yeah. which is one of the most intense areas of San Francisco. There's so much going on there. I've worked for years in the Tenderloin with, I'm the music director for Skywatchers, which is an organization that's been in the TL for 15 years, mm-hmm. an activist artist organization. And it's an amazing, there's so much that goes on down there.
Yeah.
There's so much life in capital letters that happens there.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, there's so much drama and so much fierceness that's going on mm-hmm. there, and people surviving no matter what.
Right, right.
You know, and everybody is a story. Everybody is cinematic down there, yeah. whether they believe it or not.
Yeah. No, it is an intense place, and there's good people there too. And I know it doesn't have the best reputation.
But that's just it. I mean, that's just this incredible people down there, and folks struggling but doing it and yeah. looking after each other in these situations where it just seems impossible.
Yeah.
Because human beings, we have this desire for connection. We like to congregate. We like to connect with each other. That is happening all throughout the TL.
Yeah.
People only see one thing, but it's incredible.
Yeah.
What is happening in the Tenderloin. And this is a prime example. The fact that you have this place where all different kinds of folks and a lot of LGBTQ, RSDUBWXYZ people gather. You know, I don't like to leave anybody out.
But you really, I think you got everybody covered.
Yeah, so that this is a place where people gathered. And because the thing about the Tenderloin is that no matter what you are or who you think or why you want to, there is a place for you there.
Yeah.
And so when this riot happened, these folks were like, you are not taking one of the few places that we have.
Right. Especially back then.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, we are not going down without a fight. We are not going down.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's so much history there. Mm-hmm. And it's funny. And I wonder if that history hasn't come out as much, or people aren't aware of the history, because it is the Tenderloin. I mean, because mm-hmm. like, again, the fact that this was before Stonewall, mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe too, because it was trans women as well. So I don't know if that's why.
Well, you know, it's just things happen at a certain time, and Stonewall just lit a fuse.
Yeah.
That started that whole. However, the fire didn't start there.
Right.
The fire started in a lot of little places all over the world.
Right. That we don't, we might not even
that
know
we
about.
Just don't, that we just don't know about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at a time when we live in a particular time where they're trying to erase history, it is really, really important.
Yeah, I wanted to ask
that these stories come out.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that too, as far as mm-hmm. you know, what's happening right now, as we're seeing rights for trans people being taken away and mm-hmm. people just advocating and fighting for their rights, the significance mm-hmm. of this project mm-hmm. happening mm-hmm. now. To me, and especially Ariel to me is so symbolic, and I've talked mm-hmm. to other people, particularly queer people who are in the Ariel, and mm-hmm. just the body, you know, the just the symbol of the body and flight mm-hmm. and
exactly.
freedom, and, you know, as mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. as Black people fly, I'm thinking of mm-hmm. the people, you know, who
and the whole idea that, you know, that the thing is that we all have wings, we just don't realize it.
Mm.
We all have wings. And something, when you think about just our ancestors and the fact that here you and I are, Janae, we sitting up in here talking on the radio, and what our ancestors went through so that we could be doing this at this time in our lives.
Yes.
You know, I've been a teacher and an educator for years, and a lot of my students would say, "Oh, Mr. Moore, do we have to talk about enslavement and all of that? That's there's so much shame." I said, "Baby, you're here, aren't you? What did your people have to go through for you to be sitting here driving me crazy?" Right. You know, and the fact that we're here, that you that your ancestors are your wings. Yeah. And so here you are doing what you're doing. They never could have dreamed of something right. like that. Right. But they survived long and strong enough for us to be here. Yeah.
And those people who fought the police, those are ancestors.
That's exactly you know? Right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
So somebody else can have the freedom to be and live how they wanted to live.
And that's exactly right. That's what's happening. The dancers who are flying and all of that, they are jumping off on the shoulders of those folks who were in that building.
Right. Right.
You know, and that's the thing. Our ancestors are the bricks in the path of which we walk. Mm. And that's an important thing that we need to hold on. And those stories need to be told.
And you tell story through music.
Yeah.
And I want to play one of your songs that you recorded for this project called Coffee Cups. I want people to learn more and to get more of an idea of what this project is about.
Okay.
Y'all see why I zoned out before the interview when I was listening to that beautiful, beautiful song, Coffee Cups. What was the inspiration behind that song, Melanie?
Well, the inspiration behind that song is that one of the things that they've said that really was the spark that started the whole madness was a couple of queens, you know, reacting, had a knee-jerk reaction and threw a cup of coffee in the face of a cop. And that just, you know, and that just started everything. So when I was reading about that, you know, there used to be that, you know, when you were going out to get a cup of coffee, you would say, "I'm going to get a cuppa."
Ah.
And so, yeah, I'm going to get a cuppa, uh-huh. a cup of coffee.
Right.
And so that whole thing, that's what came to my mind. I'm throw a cuppa at a cop.
Mm.
So to get, and it's that kind of like, it's kind of a sultry feeling because, yeah. you know, when things pop off, it seems like sometimes things are like in a slow motion, you know, it's almost like all of this is, so I wanted that kind of energy in the piece. And I got to see, last night we were on the street doing a tech rehearsal. So I got to see the choreography to this piece and they're on a building and they're holding cups, big cups, coffee cups, you know,
wow.
and they're doing all of this, you know, there's a duet that's happening and they're doing all of this stuff with the coffee cups going around their bodies and it's so cool. And so it was really wonderful to see the music. And it really was gratifying to me because the dancers really like the music.
That's so exciting. If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with singer-songwriter Melanie Damore. Her music is featured in the public art project Down on the Corner, and you can see it from October 3rd to the 11th in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, and it is free. I know that's so cool when you see dancers performing to your music, or just even that area of people flying, you know, in the sky.
Flying around, it's really, and it's weird too. I think the weirdest thing is hearing my voice all over the Tenderloin. I was like, this is a little interesting.
Hear your voice. And that's nice too, to hear that music too as well. I know that has to, I'm sure people go kind of be like, what? When they're walking down the street, like, what? Like, what's going on?
What is happening?
It makes you stop in your tracks. Now, now you interviewed people who live at 111 Taylor. I mean, or did you write music inspired by people who?
Oh yeah, I wrote music inspired by what they said. So a lot of, a lot of the text is what they said.
Okay. And this, and so, these are people, and 111 Taylor is a halfway house.
Right, which is where the same building where that's where the cafeteria was. And it's, you know, it's been now owned by a private prison complex. And people are trying to get that building back.
Right.
You know, to bring it back into the community again as a place of gathering. And, you know, as I said, I do a lot of work in the TL, so it's not easy. And there are, you know, it would be incredible to get the building back and put it back into the hands of the community instead of this private prison.
And the private prison is, the private prison corporation is called Geo Group. And they also have ICE processing centers nationwide.
That's exactly right.
And it's been years of trying to, it was Turks and Taylor Initiative trying to get that building back. And they want to have, like, I guess, housing for trans folks?
Yeah, resources, and, you know, have it be a place of vibrancy and connection. And community. I mean, because that's what the original Compton was all about, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's just, particularly in these days, I mean, to have an organization that does, you know, makes places for ICE to just round people up, I'm like, oh, heck no. So when Joe asked me to do this, I was really touched that she wanted me to do it. And I had absolutely no idea how I was going to approach it, you know? So that's what was really fun, because I'm pretty unconventional in my methods of music and writing. And I write for a lot of choral organizations. And so I'm a composer and conductor and all that other kind of stuff. So,
yeah. And I'm sure too, there was something about being inspired by the voices of the people.
Absolutely.
Melanie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much. You have to come back when you're working on some other stuff.
Anytime, sister. You know I'm down.
You got to come back.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
Thank you. All right, y'all. Listen to singer-songwriter Melanie Damore's music in the public art project Down on the Corner. And you can check it out from October 3rd to the 11th in San Francisco's Tenderloin District, right on the corner of Turk and Taylor Street. And it is free. Next up, a documentary about the collapse of local newspapers around the country. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds show with me, Janae Darden. Do you remember how back in the day, waking up and you go outside to get the newspaper and you see newspapers lying on many of the porches in your neighborhood? You know, many people get their news online, but that's not the only reason why newspapers have been shutting down. Hedge funds have led to the collapse of local newspapers around the country. Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink explains this journalism crisis, and you can stream it on PBS.org or on the PBS app starting today, or you can watch it on your local PBS station on October 20th. And here to chat with me about this documentary is filmmaker Rick Goldsmith. He's a 2-time Oscar-nominated documentarian and the director of Stripped for... I got tongue-tied. That last interview made me relax. And he's the director of Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Janae. I'm really happy to be here.
Yes, I'm happy you're here too. And I am so happy that you made this documentary. So I read in a 2024 State of the Local News report from Northwestern University's Medill Journalism School that, quote, since 2005, more than 3,200 print newspapers have vanished. And newspapers are disappearing at a rate of more than two per week. And that the United States has lost more than one third of its print newspapers over the past two decades. These are startling numbers. These numbers are higher, too, than when you worked on the film, Rick. So why should we be concerned about these numbers? I know where I am as a journalist, but why should we as citizens be concerned?
Well, we should be concerned because the news and information and opinion, this is what makes democracy go. And I think especially now, when really democracy is under serious attack, we need journalists more than ever. And we need news sources more than ever, and it needs to be real news, not misinformation and disinformation.
And it was interesting, too, because there was a someone, Penelope Abernathy, who's a journalist and visiting professor at Northwestern's Journalism School. And she said when a community loses a newspaper, voter participation drops, corruption goes up, misinformation and disinformation goes up, and we pay more taxes. That was, you know, I'm not surprised, but that still was alarming as well, just to hear someone say it.
Right. Yeah. She was in the film, and she was the author of that report that you quoted. It's absolutely true that many, many things happen. And why did taxes go up? I mean, that's a little bit counterintuitive.
Right.
They go up because the actuaries that work for the insurance companies, they understand that when corruption goes up, there might be more pollution of your water, that all sorts of corruption can happen at City Hall. And the city could be on the hook for lawsuits, for all sorts of bad things. And so they've got to charge more money to actually insure the cities. And that comes out of the taxpayers' profits, taxpayers' pockets.
And so you don't have watchdogs, you don't have journalists out at the city hall, covering it, or just different meetings. And so things slip. I want to play a clip from a journalist prominently featured in your film. Her name is Julie Reynolds, and she was a reporter for the Monterey County Herald. And here she talks about being suspicious of newspapers folding after she was voluntarily laid off from the paper.
We got bought in late 2011 or 2012 by this mysterious company. Nobody even knew who they were. And somebody dug up the name. It was called Alden Global Capital, and it was a New York hedge fund. Everything was downsized. We had layoffs pretty much every 6 months. All of a sudden, all our stories were being copy edited 300 miles away, where no one knew how to spell the name of the city council person in the story. So I started getting really curious about who are these people? Why are they doing this to what was a great community newspaper?
Alden's newspaper company was called Digital First Media, which owned local dailies and weeklies from coast to coast.
We started finding out this was happening all over the Digital First Media chain. I mean, sure, we had been downsizing through the years because of the internet, because they didn't know how to monetize it and didn't see it coming. But this was something way beyond that.
You know, a film is good when I talk back to the screen when I'm watching it. And I was talking back to the screen, Rick, the whole time when I watched this movie. I really encourage people to watch this documentary. Tell us why Julie Reynolds is so important in this film and in this whole story about hedge funds.
Well, what was happening in like the 2010 era was that newspapers were decreasing, and publishers found it hard enough to keep the doors open, and they would go into bankruptcy or near to it. And publishers were trying to make it work. They were trying to make a profit, but they were also trying to serve the community. And the only people that wanted to buy those failing newspapers turned out to be the hedge funds. And the hedge funds differed from the publishers of old, because they too wanted to make a profit. But what they didn't care about at all was the journalism or serving the community. And so what you found was they did everything they could to extract money from the newspapers without actually practicing journalism. In other words, they would come in, they would sell the buildings and make a profit off of that, and then they would cut the staff. And the resulting consequences were that the people in the community that were used to getting their news from the newspapers still being the largest news organizations in town, weren't getting that news anymore. Mm. And that becomes the story. So you asked specifically about Julie Reynolds. Nobody knew that these hedge funds were buying up newspapers until people like Julie Reynolds started to report on it. And within a few years of her reporting, which sparked a rebellion from the journalists at the Denver Post, that it became national news. And the editorial that was written in the Denver Post was, hey, Alden Global Capital, if you're not going to be serious about doing good journalism here, sell the paper to someone who will. Mm-hmm. And for a journalist to call out his own owner, wow, that was big news. And in fact, it made news all across the country. Mm-hmm. New York Times, The Washington Post, CBS News, et cetera, et cetera. And then we're off and running.
Yeah. And some heads did roll because people did call out the hedge funds. And Bay Area newspapers were affected by this.
Yeah, absolutely. The famed Oakland Tribune, yeah, and the Contra Costa Times, which were very, very vibrant newspapers. Mm-hmm. During this time period that we cover in the film in 2016, it turned out with these papers, they were all consolidated into, there were eight newspapers in the Bay Area that were consolidated into two, the East Bay Times and the Mercury News. And those were downsized as well. And you see reporters from that newspaper working for what was called, what still is called, Bay Area News Group, Tom Peel and Nate Gartrell. And you see them practicing journalism. That's a pretty good scene, pretty funny scene, because they're like ribbing each other, trying to make deadline,
right,
using salty language. And you get a feel for what these people do every day, slaving away and telling truth to power, calling out abuses of power, so that we can understand what's going on around us.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with filmmaker Rick Goldsmith, and you can watch his documentary, which is incredible, Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink. You can watch it on PBS.org right now, or you can stream it on the PBS app. You know, it was so interesting. I want to go back to the real estate. And that really, this whole film just hit me in my gut. But because I remember, or I've cities I've visited, and I've gone back to them, and the newspapers are gone. Because usually, the newsroom has moved. Because usually, major newspapers, they're right in downtown. They're right in downtown. And it's so sad sometimes when I go to other cities, and those newspapers and those big, beautiful old buildings, you know, like, because these newspapers may be 100 years old. So just really big, beautiful, vintage buildings with that type of architecture from that era are gone. And they're moved to the outskirts of the city. But that's too how hedge funds made their money, right? As you said, because they were selling the property, which were worth a fortune, because these are big properties in downtown.
Yeah, exactly so. The newspaper building, and, you know, for a big city, there might be 300-400 newsmen and women working in that building. Now that number might be a quarter of that, might be 100, it might be 70, it might be 60. So number one, they don't really need as large a building. But what Alden recognized was this is what's really worth a lot of money. So if we can get the newspaper for a song, that's step number one, mm-hmm, because they're a depressed property. This is called distressed asset investing. That's their scheme. So they get the newspaper for a song. That's number one. Number two, they sell the assets. So what are the most important assets? The newsroom is number one. The printing press is number two. They can get rid of that. You know, now you find printing presses serving, you know, entire states, one printing press that prints the newspapers from multiple cities. So that's number two. And number three, and they've already made back their money, is to cut the staff. Mm-hmm. So that's how they make their money. And they are really good at it. But what happens? The community suffer.
How can people make a difference? You know, people who read newspapers, because I know I see online people will get frustrated when there's a paywall and they want to read an article. And sometimes I talk to people I know and I said, well, journalists need to get paid, too. Just like you want to get paid for your work. And newspapers and magazines, they need money to survive. I mean, would it make a difference if we went back to the old school method of getting a subscription or paying for what you read as individual? I mean,
well,
so much content.
Well, I
free.
Think what's happening now is there's in every city and county in this country, they're struggling with what do we do about journalism? How do we make it work? And they're so, you know, what can people do? First of all, find out who's doing the public service journalism in your town. Now, that might be the public radio station. I mean, my dial is set to KALW. So I get a lot of my news and information from your shows and from your news reports. But often it's the public radio stations. Maybe they're making a collaborative effort with the new startup in town. And you know, you might, you know, we have Oakland Side and Berkeley Side and now Richmond Side. So those are new names to people. Those weren't around 5-10 years ago. So find out who's doing that sort of news and say, hey, I don't have to just rely on my newspaper, which might have become a ghost newspaper or might have been closed, but there's new organizations. Don't only find out who they are, support them. You know, if you've supported them at $10, you know, a month, support them at $20 a month. Dig deep, because without that kind of support, they're not going to survive. And the business models are still being worked out. How are we going to make this work for the future? You know, there's some philanthropic money that's coming in, but that's not really the answer. So plug in, find out who's doing the news, support them, and maybe be part of a news organization yourself, citizen journalism.
Well, yeah, and in the documentary, we see journalists pushing back, first by protesting what's happening, and also, too, some have left those traditional newspapers and, like you said, set up independent news organizations. You know, you mentioned public media, and thank you to Rick for listening to KLW. But you mentioned public media, and I remember towards the end of the documentary that there was some journalists making the argument that newspapers should be funded by tax dollars, and they use the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as an example. And I know you filmed this movie before the current administration in Washington, before the cuts to public media. Do you know if those people have had a change of heart, or what are their thoughts now?
Well, I think that every time we show the film, and I've gone over close to 2 years now, traveled around the country with the film, just got back from Tucson this morning, was in Orlando the week before. And people, that's one of the things, public funding for journalism, that's one of the things that people address in the question and answer period all the time. It's very controversial. And why I left it in the film, even, you're right, this was before the current administration took power, was because it's become part of the conversation. And in fact, there is legislation in many states. There is in California, in New York, in Illinois, in Pennsylvania. I just heard stuff about this, about some sort of arrangements where the legislatures have gotten involved, and they're wrestling money back from the big tech sectors, from the Googles and the Facebooks, to get back in the state's coffers to help pay for the news and the newspapers. And of course, we always have to be careful that there is some sort of kind of firewall between undue influence from either the government or from a corporation in the newsroom. But these are things that it makes it a sticky business. There's no simple answers to what is the solution to the declining newspaper crisis.
Well, I learned so much from your film, Rick, and thank you so much. I'm going to watch it again because I'm a journalist, so it meant a lot to me. But I know that film will mean a lot to people who haven't seen it yet, people who value news and value democracy and value our First Amendment. So thank you so much for making that film.
My pleasure to be on the show. And, you know, people are really responding to the film, and we're helping to generate the conversation. And that's what needs to happen over the next period of time, because without it, we can't have a vibrant democracy.
That's right. I've been speaking with filmmaker Rick Goldsmith. Stream his documentary Stripped for Parts, American Journalism on the Brink, on PBS.org and the PBS app now. You can watch it on your local PBS station on October 20th, and you can watch it tomorrow night on KRCB, which is in Rohnert Park, at 8 p.m. And while we're on the subject of journalism, I want to acknowledge someone who opened doors for journalists like me, and that's Belva Davis. In 1966, Davis became the first Black woman to be a television reporter on the West Coast when KPIX hired her. She also worked at Cron and KQED. Before that, Davis reported for the radio station KDIA, so she did have some radio roots. And one of the greatest honors in my career was in 2012 when Belva Davis presented me my first ever journalism award, which was from New American Media. She faced a lot of racism and misogyny in her career, but she persevered, and it's not easy being the first. When you're the first at something, it is not easy. I highly recommend you read her memoir. She lived by her personal mantra, don't be afraid of the space between your dreams and reality. If you can dream it, you can make it so. Belva Davis passed away last week. She was 92 years old, and I thank her for being a trailblazer. Also, rest in peace to minister, author, and activist Reverend J. Alfred Smith Sr., who was the pastor emeritus of Allen Temple Baptist Church in Oakland. He died at 94. That's all the time we have for the Sights and Sounds show with Janae Darden. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rango, board operator, Damien Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you for tuning in. We'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday at 4 p.m. Until then, be good to yourselves and each other.